For what's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Saudi Arabia and its allies in a diplomatic dispute with Qatar said today they would extend by 48 hours a deadline for Qatar to comply with their demands. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt severed diplomatic and commercial links with Doha on June 5th, accusing the government of supporting terrorism and an alliance with Iran. University of San Francisco scholar Stephen Zuna spoke with VOA about the possibility of more sanctions on Qatar.
In many respects, the sanctions already imposed are extremely severe in terms of the land, sea, and air blockade, the withdrawal of diplomatic relations, suspending their membership in the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is an important strategic and economic alliance. It's hard to think what additional sanctions could be imposed short of actual war.
Qatar has denied the other Arab nations' accusations and said such terrorism charges are baseless. Syrian state television reporting a suicide bomber in a car blew himself up in Tahrir Square, that's in central Damascus, killing at least 18, wounding many more. Syrian security forces said they had pursued three car bombers, destroyed two at the entrance to the city before they could do any damage. French President Emmanuel Macron back in Mali, where he and with the so-called G5 Sahel, those are Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mauritania, and Niger, want to form a regional anti-jihadist force. They would bolster the 4,000 French troops and the 11,000 UN peacekeepers already operating in the region. This is VOA News. World Health Organization says a rapidly spreading cholera outbreak in Yemen has claimed 1,500 lives since April and is suspected of affecting 246,000 people. The WHO's representative in Yemen says the number of suspected cases in the country's second outbreak of cholera in 6 months has multiplied tenfold just in the last 2 months. One of WHO's partners in the fight against cholera in Yemen is UNICEF. Its deputy representative in Yemen, Dr. Shirin Varki, talks about what's being done.
We are setting up special treatment centers to treat cases. We are also working on ensuring that people have safe water and sanitation services. And most importantly, we are now working at the level of the household with an army of 10,000 community volunteers who are going house to house to educate people on how they can protect themselves and their children from cholera.
WHO says one quarter of those killed by the disease in Yemen are children. President Trump discussed the threat posed by North Korea's nuclear program in separate phone calls with Chinese President Xi Jinping and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. At this week's G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, Mr. Trump will hold bilateral meetings with those two leaders. He's also due to talk with South Korean President Moon Jae-in and Russian President Vladimir Putin about what's happening in North Korea. A U.S. Navy destroyer in the South China Sea sailed near a tiny island disputed by three Asian governments, part of an operation affirming the right to passage. Chinese government, which joins Taiwan and Vietnam in claiming Triton Island, accuses the U.S. of trespassing its territorial waters. Trespassing, that is. The U.S. Pacific Fleet had no comment on China's statement or specifics about the destroyer's operations. United States has lifted a laptop ban. It's on flights from Abu Dhabi and is saying that Etihad Airways tightened security measures announced last week allowing all of this. Henry Hardeveld, travel industry analyst with Atmosphere Research Group.
They are believed to include a need for more detailed screening of checked baggage, more thorough screening of passengers' carry-on bags. There could be passenger profiling. Understandably, the Department of Homeland Security doesn't want a lot of the security detail released because if it did, those who would do harm would know what they are and try to get around it.
Abu Dhabi was one of 10 airports in 8 Middle Eastern and African countries with flights to the U.S. where the ban was in place.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Special Representative calls on the DRC's Elections Commission to publish without further delay an election timetable.
We, the people of the Congo, we want the election to be held as soon as possible, in any case, before the end of the year. This is consistent with the December 31st, 2016 agreement, which was sponsored by the Congo.
Nwashiani is an independent presidential candidate in the DRC. An upcoming vote of no confidence in South African President Jacob Zuma has been postponed by a week. And a court in Egypt upholds death sentences in the 2013 attack on a police station.
When it comes to the number of death sentences that have been handed out in the past 3 years, they are very high, unprecedented in the history of Egypt.
Hisham Kassim is a veteran Egyptian editor and publisher, and a new report highlights the number of Ebola cases prevented by Red Cross volunteers during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An opposition presidential candidate in the Democratic Republic of Congo is welcoming a call by UN Special Representative Mama Sidiku for the country's Electoral Commission to publish without further delay a timetable for elections. A December 31, 2016 agreement between the government and the opposition calls for President Joseph Kabila to stay in power until elections are held by the end of this year. A spokesman for the Electoral Commission has reportedly said only the Congolese parliament can vote on any new electoral calendar. Independent presidential candidate Noel Shiani says the international community should continue to pressure the government and the Elections Commission to hold elections before the end of this year, as mandated in the December 31st, 2016 agreement.
We, the people of the Congo, we want the election to be held as soon as possible, in any case, before the end of this year. This is consistent with the December 31st, 2016 agreement, which was sponsored by the CENCO, the Conference of Catholic Bishops, according to which there was an extension of 1 year to expire on December 31st, 2017. That's a date at which President Kabila will have to hand over to a newly elected president. So for us to have a newly elected president by December 31st, 2017, election must be organized very much before that date.
I did speak briefly to the Elections Commission chair. He said he was not ready to make a comment, but a statement attributed to the spokesperson of the Election Commission says that the electoral calendar is not for the UN to determine, but for the Congolese parliament to vote on that.
Well, the National Electoral Committee can say whatever it wants, but there is an agreement which was kind of supplement to the existing constitution. And according to those two legal documents, the election have to take place by the end of the year, 2017. So it doesn't belong to anybody, neither the CENCO, nor the parliament, nor anybody else, to give a different interpretation to that. So we are all bound to have this election according to the agreement which was published last year.
Also, it seems to me that the Elections Commission is suggesting that this comment by the UN Special Representative is an interference with the process in the DRC.
Well, I think that they have been raising those issues of interference from time to time. But the reality is that when there is a constitution or when there is an agreement brokered by the CENCO between the opposition and the presidential majority, according to which elections have to take place by the end of the year. If anyone in the international community or in the Congo reminds them or is requesting the calendar according to the agreement, in my view, there is no interference. It's just a reminder to those who have to publish this calendar to do it on time. So I don't see anything which could be interference because they are reminding them to do what they are supposed to do anyway.
Now, you are an independent candidate. We often hear from the DRC government spokesperson that the opposition is not ready because the opposition is divided. So let me ask you, let's say the timetable is published tomorrow. How ready is the opposition? How ready are you?
Well, the issue is not being ready or not. The issue is to abide by what was agreed between the opposition and the presidential majority according to the December 31st, 2016 agreement, which was sponsored by the Senko. So as far as we are concerned, we are ready to go to the election as soon as possible, and we want this election to be held before the end of the year, and we want President Kabila to hand over power to a newly elected president according to that agreement, which was brokered by the Senko. So whether somebody in the presidential majority or in the opposition is ready or is not ready, that is not the issue.
Noel Shiani is an independent presidential candidate in the DRC. He was speaking with me from Paris, France. A South African opposition member of parliament says the Speaker of Parliament is once again putting the interests of the ruling African National Congress ANC party above the overall interest of the country. This comes after the Speaker announced Sunday that the no-confidence vote against President Jacob Zuma that was originally scheduled for August 3rd had been moved to August 8th because the August 3rd date conflicts with a scheduled cabinet meeting. James Self is a member of parliament from the main opposition Democratic Alliance Party. He says while his party doesn't mind waiting for another week, such postponement is not in the interest of democracy.
We asked for this vote of no confidence some time ago, in fact in April, and so another week or so is not going to make much difference. But what we find disturbing is that once more the interests of the ANC are being put ahead of those of the country. The reason why it has been postponed is to allow the South African cabinet to have a breakaway meeting. And we don't think that that is in the interests of democracy. We think that it is a very, very important vote that we are taking that may affect the very future of this country. And for it to be postponed because there's a meeting of the cabinet seems to me completely trivial and demeaning to the task at hand.
You mentioned the African National Congress. The party is saying to its members to stand with President Zuma. To vote otherwise will be suicidal. Is this a kind of threat or what?
Well, it's always been a highly disciplined, highly centralized organization. And for that reason, I imagine that if they discovered that people had actually voted against the party line, there might be very severe consequences, including deaths or certainly death threats. That is why we expect the Speaker to determine that this would be by way of a secret ballot. The Constitutional Court has opened the way for that to happen. We do believe that in this particular case, there are compelling reasons why a secret ballot would be justified. And then if a secret ballot does in fact get ordered, it may well be that substantial numbers of the governing party would break the party line and vote for the opposition.
You know, I was reading that President Jacob Zuma has so far survived 4 no-confidence votes. So I'm wondering, why push for this one? If he survived 4, do you think he might survive this one?
It's in fact more than that. This is the 8th no-confidence vote that he is facing. And he has survived the others largely because of party discipline and the fact that the votes have been open votes. Now, there may be very good reasons for having an open vote in the sort of electoral system that we have. But in this particular instance, this is a person who was found by the Constitutional Court to have broken his oath of office. He is facing the reinstitution of 783 charges of fraud, theft, money laundering, and racketeering. This is not a person that should be president of our country. And yet he manages to survive merely because he's got an iron grasp over the party that he leads. We take the view that he should allow a secret ballot to take place, and then the members of the ruling party who are as disgusted as we are at his behavior, way that he's run this country, would have the opportunity openly, freely, to express their point of view.
Are you hopeful or are you confident that if there's a secret ballot, that there are enough people within the ANC who are willing to break rank and vote with the opposition?
No, I'm not confident, and I certainly won't count my chickens before they hatch. But what I am saying is that a secret ballot does give dissatisfied members of the ANC the opportunity to vote with their consciences and not with any fear of repercussions from the ruling party.
James Self is a member of South Africa's parliament from the main opposition Democratic Alliance Party. You're speaking with me from Cape Town. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Today is Monday, July 3rd, and I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. An Egyptian court has upheld death sentences against 20 people in the brutal 2013 attack on a police station in the Giza suburb of Kadasa. The attack, which came during a frenzy of violence following the ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, killed close to a dozen police officers. It was cited in the government's case for the use of force to quell a budding popular insurrection. Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo.
An Egyptian court has issued a final ruling upholding death sentences against 20 participants in a brutal 2013 attack on a police checkpoint in the Cairo suburb of Kardasa, in which 15 people, including 11 officers, were killed. The sentence was read out by the court at a Cairo police academy following approval by the country's highest religious authority. The attack on the police facility in Kardasa, not far from Egypt's Grand Pyramids, caught media attention in the immediate aftermath of the ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, bolstering the government's argument in putting down scattered violence, which appeared to be turning into an armed uprising. Hundreds of police recruits and military officers were killed in the violence that followed Morsi's ouster. Hundreds of Morsi supporters were also killed in the bloody dispersals of two sit-in camps and other scattered violence that followed. A video broadcast by Egyptian media shows prominent Qatar-based Egyptian cleric Sheikh Yusuf Qaradawi issuing a fatwa or religious edict in 2013 calling for the killing of Egyptian police officers and military forces. Qaradawi has denied issuing such a fatwa. Qatar is currently locked in a feud with its Gulf neighbors and Egypt over Qatar's alleged support of the Muslim Brotherhood and an assortment of regional terrorist groups, including Hamas, Libya's Ansar al-Sharia, Syria's Jabhat al-Nusra, and the Janjaweed militia in Sudan, among others. Veteran Egyptian editor and publisher Hisham Qasim tells VOA that most ordinary Egyptians are more concerned with their immediate day-to-day struggle to put food on the table and clothe themselves than with court cases such as the one Sunday in which death sentences were upheld in the Kardasa attack. But he notes Egypt has seen an unusually large number of death sentences.
When it comes to the number of death sentences that have been handed out in the past 3 years, they are very high, unprecedented in the history of Egypt.
Qasim points out that many death sentences have not yet been carried out, and opponents of the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, including the Muslim Brotherhood, are looking for means to resort to international legal bodies or rights organizations to use such sentences against Sisi. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The European Union has pledged to support Italy as it continues to admit thousands of migrants who are crossing every day from North Africa across the Mediterranean. Italy has threatened to shut its ports to foreign registered boats carrying migrants. So far this year, nearly 80,000 people have made the journey and more than 2,000 have died. Henry Richwell reports from London.
Oh, Most of the tens of thousands of people plucked from the Mediterranean this week have been taken to ports on the Italian coast. They are severely dehydrated, usually malnourished, and suffering from infections and skin diseases. Marcella Cray of Doctors Without Borders spoke to VOA via Skype from the group's rescue ship, Aquarius, as it disembarked over 1,000 migrants at the Italian port of Corigliano Calabro.
We also see the results of people actually being physically assaulted, sexually assaulted, tortured.
Italy's representative to the European Union has warned the situation is unsustainable and threatened to stop vessels of other countries from bringing migrants to its ports. Cray sympathizes with Italy's position.
We have not in any way formally informed of this by the Italian government. My first impression of this is that the main thing is here is that it's actually a cry for help coming from the Italian government. And it would be actually good for other EU member states to take a bit more responsibility.
EU Migration Commissioner Dimitris Avramopoulos offered Italy his support.
Italy is under huge pressure, and we're not going to leave this country alone.
Italy is obliged to take in the migrants, says refugee law expert Professor Jeff Gilbert of the University of Essex, also via Skype.
The law of the sea, international refugee law and international human rights law are all coming into play together. Italy has the right to protect its own borders. While I have a lot of sympathy for the Italian situation, I do not believe Italy can send back boats, even boats that are seaworthy, on into the Mediterranean.
Gilbert says Rome is likely trying to force the implementation of the 2015 EU agreement to share refugees across the bloc, which has so far made little progress. This week, more than 400 migrants in Italy clashed with police at the French border, demanding to be allowed through. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A new report highlights the number of Ebola cases prevented by Red Cross volunteers during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa from 2013 to 2016. According to the study published in the journal PLOS, safe and dignified burial by volunteers may have prevented more than 10,000 Ebola cases altogether in the three affected countries. Sierra Leone Red Cross Ebola Green Response Assistant Daniel James talks to Ricky Stryak about their work during the outbreak.
Those who took up burials really created an impact on the country as a whole. Initially, volunteers started burial activities in Kailahun on the 17th July 2014. And then the outbreak escalated to other districts, and there came the need for volunteers of Red Cross to be recruited in all of the 13 districts in the country. And so the support from Federation, 14 teams of SDB teams were recruited in all of the 13 districts.
What future role in public health do you think that these volunteers can play now that they've been trained in certain areas and the Ebola outbreak is no longer ongoing?
We still have our volunteers who are doing PSS, social mobilization, in the communities. Of course, those activities are traditional activities for the Red Cross. Like the PSS, social mobilization and contact tracing has been a normal activity going on. It only came on a larger scale when we have the outbreak of Ebola. And that brought more training for these volunteers to be more knowledgeable and new skills and new ideas about PSS, social mobilization and contact tracing. And then now, the new one is the burials. That volunteers were trained in conducting safe and dignified burials during the outbreak of Ebola, which was a very dreadful disease.
As I understand it, no Red Cross burial team members contracted Ebola or died from Ebola during the outbreak. That's correct, yeah?
Yeah, that information is correct. Reason being that why none of them got infected or got sick or got died is because I, as a beginner, received a professional training from MSF and WHO, and then I improve on the skill and knowledge on myself by searching through the internet to see to get more information. And with the support of Federation, these volunteers, we are trained now all over the country in safe identified areas. And there was supervision going around as I was supervising them, making sure that all the protocols we are followed, and we are not making any mistake. We make sure that volunteers don't make any mistake in the field. We are having officers at this level to supervise the volunteers to make sure that these volunteers do not compromise with the outbreak. So we are under serious supervision. They are receiving frequent trainings and refresher trainings so that every day as they go to the field, they are keep reminded of the danger and protocols to follow so that nobody makes a mistake in the field. Because the motto was, your first mistake is your last mistake.
That was Daniel James, Sierra Leone Red Cross Ebola Green Response Assistant. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Freetown. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
A very good morning to you, James. We begin with the 2017 edition of the COSAFA Cup being organized by the Council of Southern African Football Association for countries in Southern Africa, where defending champions Bafana Bafana failed to progress in this year's COSAFA Cup following a 1-0 loss to Tanzania at the Royal Bafokeng Stadium on Sunday evening. The Taifa Stars, who are guests at the 14-team Southern African Championship, now meet Zambia in the first of Wednesday's semifinals at the Marlenk Stadium, while Zimbabwe are up against Lesotho. South Africa now face Botswana in the COSAFA Cup plate semi-finals on Tuesday. And now to matches played in the CAF Champions League this past weekend. Abbas Amidu scored twice as CAPS United of Zimbabwe stunned Zamalek of Egypt with a 3-1 victory in Harare on Sunday as the group round of matches continues in the CAF Champions League. CAPS are away to leaders USM Alger of Algeria next Sunday in the final series of group fixtures and must win to finish in the top two and make the last eight of the Elite African Club competition. Zamalek must also win at home against Al Ahly of Tripoli if they are to avoid a shock elimination. USM and Al Ahly Tripoli, who drew 1-1 on Friday night, have 8 points, CAPS 6 and Zamalek 5, in one of the most competitive of the four groups. In the CAF Confederations Cup, Al Hilal Ubeid of Sudan reached the CAF Confederations Cup quarterfinals for the first time and at the club's first attempt on Saturday by winning 2-0 at home against Recreativo Libolo of Angola. Mouloudia Alger of Algeria are also through to the last eight stage of the secondary African Cup competition after a 2-0 home win over Platinum Stars of South Africa on Friday. Elsewhere, Club African brushed aside Rivers United of Nigeria 2-0. The victory took the Tunisian Giants to the top of Group A standings with 9 points, while Nigeria's Rivers United remained fourth with 6 points. Tunisia's CS Sfaxien secured their third win in their CAF Confederations Cup Group B campaign when they beat Swaziland's Mbane Swallows 3-1 in Lobamba on Sunday afternoon. The win sees CS Sfaxien still in second place in the group with 10 points, a point behind leaders MC Alger, who beat Platinum Stars 2-0 on Saturday. Swallows are third in the group with 4 points, while Stars prop up the bottom of the standings with 2 points. TP Mazembe bagged a vital 1-0 win over CF Monana at a match that was played at the Stade Angoji in Libreville on Sunday. The win leaves the Ravines placed at number 2 with 9 points from 5 matches to boost their knockout spot aspirations. Elsewhere, Kampala Capital City Authority claimed a 3-1 win over FCUS Rabat. In basketball news, FIBA Africa Basketball's governing body has confirmed that Tunisia and Senegal will jointly host this year's FIBA AfroBasket. Angola was earlier proposed by FIBA Africa to host the tournament, but it later turned out that the country will hold its general elections around the same period. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing you a very good week.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we will examine the contributions politicians of African descent are making and changing toward the political realities in the United States. We'll also discuss the new faces arriving on the political landscape on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.